1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. 32 million Latinos will be eligible to vote in November. It's the largest minority voting bloc in the electorate, with enormous power to shape the outcome of the presidential race. And yet, the main presidential debates have never had a Latino moderator. Could this year be the first? Joining us now from Miami is Ilia Calderon. She's a news anchor for Univision's evening newscast alongside Jorge Ramos. She's also the author of a new memoir called My Time to Speak, Reclaiming Ancestry and Confronting Race. Ilia, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So the title of your memoir, My Time to Speak, what is it about this moment that prompted you to speak up?
Well, I actually started writing the book 2 years ago, but sadly it's timely now, and it was going to be timely a year ago, 10 years, 20 years, and it's going to be timely 5 years from now. Sadly, because racism is very present, a lot of people are being denied opportunities at work to study, and there is a big difference and a breach between the black population, not only here in the United States, but in Latin America as well. I can see it in Colombia, and I've seen it and I experienced it in my life. I just started writing a book 2 years ago because I felt comfortable with my story. I wasn't afraid anymore, and I found my voice, and I had a platform when I can impact more people.
You said you weren't afraid anymore. What were you afraid of?
Well, I was afraid about talking about those experiences when I had to face racism since I was 10 years old. I decided to just ignore and just put it 6 feet under, because it touched me and it hurt me so much. And I didn't want those experiences to get in my way of becoming, you know, a professional, finishing my studies, and I just decided to keep silent. And my book, My Time to Speak, is also a call to respect the moment of a person that have those experiences that hurt them so much, and encourage people to find the moment and find their voices to speak.
Well, you grew up in a predominantly black town in Colombia. Tell us about your early years.
It is called El Chocó. Is one of the most abandoned regions in Colombia, predominantly black, by the governments, by the local politicians. And just imagine, I'm talking about the 70s, we didn't have electricity. We didn't have, I had to iron my clothes with a charcoal iron. I had to walk miles to walk to school. It was humid, it was hot, it rained a lot. We had to cross a river on a small boat to attend school. I tried ice cream for the first time when I was 5 years old. Mm. Thanks to one of our neighbors, as I tell in my books, that had a generator and provide us a couple of days a week some energy, some power, so we can eat ice cream and have some food refrigerated. But it was, you know, I was happy until I left to Medellin to start my sixth grade. And I attended a school, a religious Catholic school. And I was the only one black in my school. And for the first time, someone called me or say something racism in my face. It was a bigger girl. She was in another grade. And in the morning at the assembly, she said something like, she said, negro ni mi caballo, which means black, not even my horse. And it hurt me a lot. It was a moment that defined a lot of things that I did after. And as I told you, I decided just to put it away. I didn't tell my mom. I didn't tell my family anything about this episode, because she was left back in my country, in my hometown. And I didn't want her to feel bad for me, and she was working so hard just to, you know, to pay for my school, and I didn't want to cause her any bad moments, and yeah, I decided to hide it and keep going with my studies. And later in Medellin, I attended. Yes.
What was race and racism something that was openly discussed when you were growing up?
It was not, and still is not. We in Latin America, from Argentina to Mexico, including the islands in the Caribbean, we need to recognize that there is racism, and racism is a part of the upbringing in the families. Those microaggressions have been part of the Latino culture forever. About the hair, about the preference for the lighter skin. When the grandmas or great grandmas or the mothers tell the girls, marry a white guy because we need to make or create a better race, for the race to be better, for the kids not to have the curly hair. It's something that we need to recognize and we need to address. We need to bring that conversation to our tables. And we need to start eradicating racism.
We're speaking with Ilia Calderon, an evening news anchor for Univision, about her new memoir, My Time to Speak, Reclaiming Ancestry and Confronting Race. We'll be right back with more of this conversation. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
The past is never past, and every headline has a history.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rund Abdelfattah, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Each week, we go back in time to better understand the present,
bringing lesser-known stories and perspectives to the surface.
Subscribe and listen to Throughline from NPR.
I'm Jen White. We're talking with Ilia Calderon, an evening news anchor for Univision. Her new memoir is called My Time to Speak, Reclaiming Ancestry and Confronting Race. Ilia, we got this question for you from Alexis on Facebook, who says, how do you feel about your experience navigating the myriad social hierarchies and structures in the U.S., given your dual identity? Do you experience a dual immigrant experience in the U.S., where you're sometimes seen as a Latina immigrant and other times as a Black immigrant? How do those experiences differ?
Yes, I have. Thank you for your question. And as I say, telling my book, one of those experiences was not being identified as one or the other for other people. Sometimes I like going to a store when there was an African-American lady sitting behind the desk, and she spoke to me in English immediately. And when I told her I speak Spanish, I am Hispanic, and she said, like, oh, I didn't know there were Black in Latin America. Or for Latin people, or for other Latin people, or for the Hispanic in the United States, not acknowledging that there is a Black community in Colombia. What the country sells in telenovelas and productions, and even when the coffee, our number one product, is being sold, you never see Black people as a part of those promotions. And it's hard for others to know that we have a very important Afro-descendant community in Colombia. So it was hard for me, for coming from other Hispanic people, telling me that I didn't know there were Blacks in Colombia. That tells you how the efforts about to whiten our history, the efforts to hide our history. We had a president, the only black president in Colombia, and his picture was hidden for 157 years until former president Juan Manuel Santos decided to give him a space in the Hall of Presidents in the Casa de Nariño, which is the presidential house. So that tells you about how the story of African descendants has been hidden or tried to erase for so many years.
Well, you're a journalist during a presidential election here in the U.S. Latinos are now the largest minority in the voting electorate, but they're far from a monolith. I mean, the term Latino already encapsulates so many different groups. But what are some key issues you're hearing from that voting bloc leading up to the election?
Yeah, according to, I was reading the other day, and according to Pew Research, in the past elections, in 2016 elections, the interests of the Hispanic community were also focused in economy, healthcare, terrorism, education, of course, as well as immigration, which is a big issue for us. But now, in the midst of a pandemic, I think we have a big challenge. Latino vote, Voto Latino, reported that so after the George Floyd's killing, a 2,750% jump in Latino registration. Now we need to keep that motivation to show up and vote on November. So from the parties, the Democrats and the Republican candidates needs to stop seeing the Latino vote as a monolith. We are different. We come from different countries, and we all had different experiences in the political field in our countries, from Colombia to Nicaragua, Venezuela, Argentina, and Cuba. We are all completely different, and we have interests. So the campaigns need to address and make, you know, a more or a bigger approach to the Latino vote, as not as a monolith.
Well, Chris asks this question on Facebook. How does the Latino community, which like every demographic is not monolithic but has correlations, weigh the interests of immigration and DACA, which align with the Democratic platform, against the social conservatism that might align with the Republican Party?
I think the immigration is a big issue for the Latino community. We are all immigrants, some with papers, some without immigration papers. I think it's a main interest for us. And at the end, we are going to, you know, probably align with who is going to defend the immigration, or who is going to give a preference to the issue of immigration. DACA, for example, the situation of those young dreamers, and the fact that it is not defined, and the fact that President Trump decided only to renew DACA for 1 year. And, we need to have the perspective of, as a big community, which ones are our issues. And as I told you, not only immigration, but only, you know, as well, healthcare, terrorism, economy, and education. But yes, it is important for us.
Well, again, in your book, you address the experiences of racism that you had in Colombia and here in the States. We're in this moment in the U.S. where we're having very difficult conversations around racism and police violence. How are you reflecting on this moment, both as a journalist and as a Black Latina?
It is a sad moment to see that this is 2020 and we are still living inequality and police brutality against the African-American community. It is hard to see and it is hard to report. In fact, we can say that there is a little bit more empathy from other groups, but it is just, you know, I think it's a moment where we can, you know, it's a moment that we can't let go. It's a moment that we need to take advantage of and start pushing for, you know, a real change, and not only from society, but from the institutions.
Well, I'm thinking back to you as a little girl in Colombia, and you as the first Afro-Latina to anchor an evening newscast for a major broadcast network in the U.S. How much does that matter to you, and how much do you think it matters to young people who are watching you?
I think representation matters, and it matters. It mattered at that moment. I didn't realize how much, because our community is basically kept silent. But when you go on the streets and you see a black girl that tells you, you inspired me to study journalism, you inspired me to want to work on TV, and you inspired me to fight for my dreams, then you realize that what they see on the screen is important for them. Growing up, I never saw a black family portrayed as the families that we saw on the TV that coming from the United States, not in the productions in Colombia. Black people were always slaves, or were the people or the service in the houses, or the ones working on the fields. Never saw a family or a show as the ones that were produced in the United States as a beautiful family, educated African descendants with a beautiful house. We never saw that on TV. So for everybody, seeing someone that reached a big position, it was a big issue. It was important. My mom, when I brought her to the United States for the first time, and she saw a black person driving a very expensive car, she was like, oh my God, we'd never see that in our country. First, because we don't have the same opportunities to dream big and study, and we live always in abandoned communities, but because our TV and in our screens, we don't see that. We don't see it.
That's Elia Calderon, an evening news anchor for Univision. Her new memoir is called My Time to Speak, Reclaiming Ancestry and Confronting Race. Elia, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Voters in Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, Washington, and Arizona have been making some important decisions over their nominees for congressional and state offices. And the result of the last big primary day of the season are now coming in. That's our cue to welcome back Reed Wilson. He's a national correspondent for The Hill and the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So first off, walk us through some of yesterday's hottest races and the results we have so far.
So the most consequential races on Tuesday came in states like Michigan, Missouri, Kansas. And I want to start with Kansas just because it's a race that's going to have consequence in November. Voters were picking a Republican nominee to replace Pat Roberts, a senator who's retiring. And they opted for Congressman Roger Marshall, who represents basically the western two-thirds of the state. He beat out Chris Kobach. You might remember that name. Kobach is an immigration hardliner who helped advise President Trump. Kobach lost a governor's race 2 years ago, and Republicans were worried that if he were the Republican nominee for the Senate seat, that seat might be in jeopardy. And as the map is expanding and beginning to favor Democrats more and more, the idea of putting another seat in competition is not something that Republicans wanted to do. So they got their candidate there, their preferred candidate, Roger Marshall, beating a close ally of President Trump in Chris Kobach. In Missouri, voters opted to expand Medicaid by a narrow margin, but they voted for it anyway. And in a fascinating congressional district out in St. Louis, a Black Lives Matter activist named Cori Bush beat in a sitting congressman, William Lacey Clay. Lacey Clay and his father have represented this district for about half a century. And the idea that now that a progressive activist has come in and beat him is a real surprise. It's on par with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beating Joe Crowley a couple of years ago, and some of the other progressive challengers we've seen be successful this year. So a couple of pretty fascinating results right there. And then in my home state of Washington, no terribly huge surprises, but Congressman Denny Heck, I think this is a bit notable, is a rising star in Congress, a member of the Intelligence Committee. He decided to retire this year, and he is running instead for lieutenant governor, which is a race that, you know, a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to, but it's not lost on anybody that if Joe Biden becomes president, Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, may be asked to take on a prominent role on climate change, his signature issue, in a Biden administration, and then maybe Denny Heck becomes governor.
I've got to check in on my home state of Michigan. What did we see there?
So in Michigan, the biggest races were not terribly competitive. There's going to be a Senate race in November. Neither the Republican nor the Democratic nominees faced any real opposition. The one notable race came in Detroit itself, where Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, she's a member of the Squad, as they call that group of young progressive women activists who are members of Congress now. She won her primary by a fairly comfortable margin over Brenda Jones, who was a longtime city official. That was a rematch of 2 years ago when Tlaib barely held off Brenda Jones. This time around, it was a pretty convincing result.
What about the pandemic and its impact on voting? We heard some real horror stories this primary season. How successful was the rollout yesterday?
So things look like they went relatively smooth yesterday. I will say there have been some reports about people in Michigan specifically not getting their absentee ballots or their absentee ballot applications on time. That raises more questions about whether or not the Postal Service is equipped to handle what we're going to see in terms of a massive surge of interest in mail-in voting. One statistic, just to sort of shine a light on how likely we are to see that surge, 4 years ago, in Minnesota, I just saw this statistic a couple of minutes ago, about 25,000 people requested absentee ballots in their primary. In 2018, about 50,000 requested ballots in their primary. And this year, 10 days before the primary, more than 550,000 people have already requested absentee ballots, 10 times the previous record. So that tells you that more and more people are turning to vote by mail just to avoid this virus.
Well, speaking of the virus, I understand you're currently in Washington State, which has seen a huge surge in cases in the last few weeks. Tell us what's going on there.
So I'm in a small area called Okanagan County, basically the North Cascades, the heart of apple-picking territory, apples, cherries, peaches, and the wine, of course, that Washington State is known for. And there's this really stark dichotomy here between small towns like Twisp and Winthrop, which are basically vacation places for people from Seattle and the west side of the mountains. There are very, very few cases in these small communities where people from Seattle flock every weekend. They're very wealthy, they're very white, and we're just not seeing a lot of cases here. Just on the other side of the county, in a small town called Brewster, we've seen a huge surge in cases. There were 400 or so in the last week. That's effectively 1% of the entire county that has tested positive for this virus in just the last week. Brewster is an apple-picking area, and the virus is spreading pretty rapidly among migrant workers. So that's a real challenge that state officials are having to deal with. How do you deal with workers who are in, you know, very tightly packed dorms? How do you keep them safe?
We're catching up with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and Reed in a moment.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
This is 1A. Let's get back to the latest in political news with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. President Trump has responded to the pandemic and the surge we're seeing in infections. He sat down with Axios's Jonathan Swan last week and brought his own COVID-19 charts to the interview. Here's part of what he had to say.
Because we do more tests, we have more cases. In other words, we test more. Now take a look. The top one, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. The top, Jonathan.
If hospital rates were going down and deaths were going down, I'd say terrific. You deserve to be praised for testing, but they're all going up.
You know, they very rarely talk.
60,000 Americans are in hospital.
If you watch the news or read the papers, they usually talk about new cases, new cases, new cases.
I'm talking about death.
Well, you look at death. Death is way down from where it was.
It's 1,000 a day. It was 2,500. It went down to 500. Now it's going up again.
Excuse me. Where it was is much higher than where it is right now.
Reid, how does the messaging out of the White House stack up against what we're seeing around the country?
Well, I got to say, first of all, my old colleague at The Hill, Jonathan Swan, did a great job in that interview. What the White House is talking about is this notion that because we are testing more, which is true, we are reaching new heights in the number of tests that we've conducted, we have therefore more cases. And the problem with that is that the number of tests are not sufficient to find the actual number of cases. The CDC has estimated that more than 10 times as many people have actually contracted this virus as have tested positive. There are just so many people who are asymptomatic that who maybe just suffer through some minor symptoms and recover that they don't ever interact with somebody who would test them and therefore find a positive case. So they're really hiding in this notion that because the testing is up, and by the way, it's not up to the standard that we actually need to control this virus, therefore we have more cases, and therefore the virus is not as dangerous or deadly as some people are making it out to be. That's just not reality. It is, as Jonathan pointed out, the number of people in hospitals today is more than 60,000. The number of people who are dying, more than 1,000 a day. Florida last week set records for the number of deaths on four consecutive days. They broke their record each day. That's not the kind of trajectory that people want. And, you know, the funny thing is, the White House is vastly out of step with the huge majority of the American public who are nervous about this virus. They don't want to rush back to school. They see the potential for rampant new outbreaks that could overwhelm the healthcare system. Public opinion is not on the president's side on this, no matter how much he talks about more testing.
Well, you reported that Republicans are increasingly concerned about the president's path to reelection, given his lackluster response to the pandemic and the economic crisis, and that they've started thinking through what a post-Trump GOP could look like. Are they coming up with answers?
Well, everybody's got their own answer. I suppose if you get 10 people in a room, they'll have 10 different answers. But we've started to see the first inklings of what a 2024 presidential campaign might look like. You know, Ted Cruz has been, the senator from Texas, has been stumping on the campaign trail and talking a lot more about fiscal conservatism at a time when we're spending trillions of dollars on response to the virus. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas has gotten involved. Senator Rick Scott is taking a hard line on pandemic spending in Congress, and you can expect him, you can expect all of these guys to run for president in 2024. Even people like Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador and South Carolina governor, Mike Pence, of course, the vice president who's certain to run, they're all sort of becoming more visible, and that's a sign that, you know, once 2020 happens, President Trump is extremely unlikely to be on a ballot ever again. Either he will have won and therefore can't run for a third term, or he will have lost, and if he loses, he will stay in the conversation, but he's extremely unlikely to run again in 2024. So Republicans are now thinking about this. What does the future of the party look like when they have been so incredibly dominated for the last 4 years, 5 years really, by one person whose vision of the party is more about personality than it is about any set ideology?
Mm-hmm. I want to turn now to presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden's vice presidential search. Now, the Biden campaign was slated to announce a running mate this week, but they've extended that process by a week or two. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, the co-chair of the selection committee, addressed the search on MSNBC's Morning Joe yesterday.
We have amazing women that have been a part of this process. We're keeping them all. We vetted them heavily. All of them have passed a vet. And now in this next week and a half, Mr. Biden can spend some time with them. And I know he's going to pick a vice president that reflects the kind of relationship he had with Barack Obama. He told us at the beginning of this, I'm not looking for a geographic, a demographic, or a political choice. I'm looking for somebody who can serve the American people and be the closest counselor to me in the White House.
So, Reid, what's the latest on this competition to become VP? Any front runners emerging?
Well, you know, I've been struck by the fact that this has been the most public vice presidential search that I can remember. I mean, you know, 8 years ago when Joe Biden or when Barack Obama was looking for his own running mate, that was 12 years ago now. God, mm-hmm. Time flies. It was, you know, that we knew that the selection was coming down to basically three people, Joe Biden, Evan Bayh, and Tim Kaine. But there wasn't a lot of jockeying and everybody was doing that, you know, like, oh, I'm not really interested thing where they demur and pretend that they're not interested when in fact, of course, they are. This time, one of the things that struck me is the women who are on the long list have all been totally open about how much they would love to be vice president, and their surrogates have even gone around mounting campaigns for them, whether it's supportive or even throwing some opposition research about some of the other candidates. For example, as Karen Bass, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, became a more and more prominent voice, suddenly there started to be some clips about her comments about Castro in the past, and some questions raised about Cuba policy, which is, of course, hugely important to a big population in a swing state like Florida. Kamala Harris, a senator from California, has been at or near the top of the list for the most part, and it appears that there was a relatively organized campaign within the Biden campaign itself to sort of give Joe Biden more options. It was not lost on them that Kamala Harris attacked Joe Biden in that first Democratic debate. You remember that it was a pretty sort of stark moment in the campaign. She does not appear to be sort of remorseful about that, and that is now that's her answer is basically, well, that's politics, which is correct. But, you know, that has rubbed some on the Biden team the wrong way.
I mean, what does all of this tell you about the Biden campaign itself, that the VP position has become this competitive and this important?
Well, I think it tells you that it is as consequential as any vice presidential search in the last, I don't know, since JFK picked Lyndon Johnson. It is a position that will automatically set up a front runner for the Democratic nomination either in 2024, if a President Biden decided not to run for re-election, or in 2028 when he would be done after the second term. So this is a selection that matters, and Joe Biden is picking the future of the Democratic Party. He has talked about being sort of a transitional president rather than a transformational president, and he is sort of charting the course, what that transition is going to look like and to whom that transition is going to favor.
Well, Reid, really quickly, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. What's the status of coronavirus relief on Capitol Hill? Are we seeing any loosening of the gridlock?
It appears that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is willing to give a little on the $600 a week in extra unemployment benefits, but there's still a big difference between the Republican package that stands at $1 trillion that has not passed the Senate and the Democratic package that stands at about $3 trillion that has already passed the House. The White House is sort of tangentially involved in these negotiations, at the end of the day, it looks like this is once again going to fall on an agreement between Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, and you know, we'll see how quickly they do it. But a lot of people now are entering their second week without that extra $600, and that is raising concerns that a bad economic recession might get a lot worse.
Well, before we go, what are you watching over the next couple of weeks?
Well, we're watching coronavirus cases and hoping that these positive trends in states like Arizona, Florida, even here in Washington, continue to trend downward, hoping that the states that are of concern, places where the cases are rising, can really turn that corner. We need this sort of concerted effort to stop this virus, and you know, we just have to hope that we haven't loosened up too much.
That's Reid Wilson. He's a national correspondent for The Hill and author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reid, it's always great to have you on.
Thanks a lot, Jen.
Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. This conversation was produced by Katie Klein, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.